Good morning, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Thanks for being here. I really appreciate you showing up. So let's go ahead and get on into it. I've been thinking a lot this morning about life, as always. I have this chewing, gnawing piece of my consciousness that is incessantly curious and wants to understand and make meaning of this world. And that human reason is not only my most powerful tool, but it tends to be a hindrance to my approach towards life. So what do I mean by reason? Reason has a lot of purposes. It's what makes us human, I believe. We are all incapable of knowing what other life forms experience, but I'm hesitant to say that an aardvark has the same neurosis as a human being. And when I say neurosis, I mean the misapplication of our reasonable element in order to torture ourselves and to further make the illusionary aspects of reality less real and less manipulatable. We manipulate all kinds of things in our world in order to meet some end, an end goal. And so all the contraptions, all the means, and all the strategies to get to an end is the manipulation of them. We can manipulate things and we can manipulate people. And when we turn people into means to our ends, we turn people into things and we shred their unique individuality as beings in themselves. So living in this world is complex, and being able to make decisions is contradictory often. So how do we really approach and treat people well? This has been something that I have deemed as a purpose in my life, is to treat people as well as physically possible. And I've been called a softie, and I have been called emotional, and I've let my emotions strangle me away from my purpose in several instances. But I still feel that my primary purpose on this world is to be a source of love, compassion, and to be able to help as many people as I possibly can. And I was having a conversation with a coworker last week that I felt uncomfortable in, yet I learned a lot about myself and about my coworker and about the possible interconnections of these different ways of looking at this thing called the world. But my coworker was trying to explain to me how his selfishness was human, and he was trying to validate it in a way. And he uses this example time and time again about how if he were on the Titanic, how if I were on the Titanic, and he would ask me this in a hypothetical sense, would I save a stranger and would I sacrifice my family for a stranger? To which he passionately would say, I would help my family every single time and fuck you. You know, and it's not as easy as a fuck you for me to be able to say that, even though I understand the reasoning of this opinion of his, because I wouldn't sacrifice my family for a stranger. I would definitely put some preference towards my son, time and time again. But I'm not on the Titanic, and these are hypotheticals. And so the way I explained it to him was that there are all sorts of things going on outside of my head and outside of us, outside of this building that we're in, and I pointed outside the window to people walking down the sidewalk. And I said, all those people have all kinds of lives, and I can't really affect them. But me and you, we're here right now. You know, like, we're here together often. This is a real relationship right here, and we're actually interacting, you know? And my purpose in this reality, in this interaction, this moment right here that actually exists, I want to treat you as well as physically possible, and I want to be of benefit to you. When I see you walk into the door and I say, good morning, so-and-so, I am so appreciative to see you, and I'm grateful that you're here, and I want that compassion to grow, and I give it because that's my purpose. And he looked at me, and he quieted down and was like, oh, yeah, yeah, I get what you mean. You know, and then it kind of got quiet for a second, and I could watch the gears clunk in his head, and then I saw more negativity arise, and passionately he began to enunciate another situation where he had been effed over, or he had been screwed in some act of unfairness or some unethical conduct by some old past presence. And therefore, now because we've been done wrong, now this needs to cloud and cover every future experience, which is how trauma works. You know, we're hurt. We have this damage done to us, right? And once the scar's there, we have to be defensive in order to not let it happen again. To be mauled by a tiger and to easily and happily walk back into a tiger's cage after having saved your own life somehow is stupidity. Doing the same thing over and over again and expecting the same results is insanity. So there's a complexity to how we go forward, but we do it in a healthy way. And I find that very intriguing. So I recently finished a book by Mr. John Stuart Mill, and it was an essay titled Utilitarianism. I have a great episode on utility back in the backlog. If you just look for a title with utility in the name, you get a much further explanation of my opinions of it. But towards the end of this essay, he speaks about justice and the impracticability of justice. And he goes into the etymology, which is the history of the word itself, and he goes into the Latinizations and how French used justicia and like all these different ways that the concept has evolved over time. And I think he was arguing for a new system, because this concept of law, which a law is a norm that's strictly enforced, and in order for something to be considered wrong, usually that act is punishable. And so to be enacted with punishment, that thing that you did, there has to be an implied other action that should have happened. This ought to, what you ought to have done. And so this again further implies a more abstract clothing of personality that you should be wearing, that now we will call duty. You know, what is your duty? What is expected of you by society? What are your roles and your performance that are almost intrinsic, innate, that you're born with? And if you go against these duties, if you act incongruently with what you ought to have done, whether or not you consciously know what that is, then you are punishable, right? And so I hope you can see how abstract and how, like, a lot of assumptions are really made within this system of justice. And it becomes very hard to have a set of laws for absolutely everybody, which is where Mr. Stuart Mills utility comes in, and he has a lot of different arguments about what happiness is. Because I guess if you don't remember, utility is a system of not quite governance, but a system of morals that we use in order to judge the best actions for a situation. And there can be a lot of different variables that are put into these equations in order to crunch a good system of decision making. However, what is happiness? Is happiness purely just a hedonistic pleasure? But if your or my hedonistic pleasure happens to be a burden on somebody else, is that really the greater good, quote unquote? Becomes very murky to establish virtue when you have a bajillion interpersonal connections and all these different moving parts of people who are trying to do each other well, and some are point blank trying to do each other wrong, you know? So this concept of greater happiness has to be, I think, the happiness of the Übermensch, the Overmind. A principle from one of my favorite German philosophers that I have definitely sort of made my own, because my concept of the Übermensch is definitely a little bit separated from his. His was this perfect man, the Overman, the self-actualized man in the world of Mr. Maslow, this transcended, illuminated man of the Buddha and Buddhism. So this concept of the ideal being that we want to be is the perfunctory Übermensch. But I'm obsessed with this group mind that ties us all together. You know, an example I've used in the past is that on a team, whether it's sports or a work team, maybe even a family team, you know, we have this unspoken communication when we're really, really attuned to our mate, our coworker, whatever that other is, and then all of a sudden is born a new psychic being that is the totality of us when I becomes we. And there can be very large teams. Like, nationalities are these incredibly abstract, huge overminds, these group minds. Like, my home country of the United States, I feel, has this like infantile, toddling toddler of an overmind just like running through the playground of the world and knocking over other kids and other group minds for other countries and other nations. Like, it's belligerent, you know? And that's also because I feel that the larger and the bigger these groups get, like, you can have one smart person, very intelligent, two smart people might be able to benefit each other. 100 smart people in a room, the IQ starts to go down. You know, the more people we get together, the harder it is to come to clear decision making. And I think that there is a ceiling for how big human communities should be. And I think how large our communities are now might be part of the issue that we have so many inadequacies in governmental lawmaking, where we have so many people that feel separated and not part of the dominant feeling of morality, if that makes any sense. So, when it comes to utility, when it comes to trying to make the greatest happiness, we have to look at all the different Venn diagrams, really, like the interconnecting concentric circles, these various overminds that are all interacting like a Russian nesting doll, where there's dolls inside dolls inside dolls. You know, like, it's so difficult to just say on the surface with individuals how to deem good ethical moral codes and conducts. And I think what my friend Mr. Mill was saying back in the 1800s was that there should be some sort of overall and maybe just a little bit of thinking on how that should be done. And this is a very macro scale argument. This is not a micro scale. This is not something we could implement totally in our own lives, which we can, though, within our own subjective frames of being, as we go and do our things within our little robotic actions, as we perform our roles like little good stagehands and push the pieces around for society. Even as we do that, even as we are our toddle, we can still consider the consequences of our own actions within a much bigger world of interactions. It takes a step away from self-centeredness. It takes a lot of empathy and a practiced empathy that takes consideration into respecting every single thing that's part of this world. And in a country like America that is bound into materialism and is so obsessed with isolationism and individuation that even the group mind of my country is heading towards this nationalistic concept where, even though I think large communities aren't possible, I think that we often think that too many communities, like if we had, so, all right, here. I had this thought experiment back in high school where I called it a true communistic society, and not like totalitarian or authoritarian examples like Russia, Soviet Republic, China, North Korea, but a true commune style society. So Serbia, ancient Serbia, had, I think it was like 1 or 2 million people that were all loosely connected tribes. Each tribe had its own leader, and they had a confederation like the Iroquois Confederation or the Navajo Confederation, one of those two, where you had all these separate groups of people who had their own leadership, their own roles, but they came together as a people because they had this loose trust possibly in each other. And when it came to war, and when like the Mongols came into Serbia and stuff like that, these people were able to still come together. Even though they had small tribes, small communities, they came together into millions to support each other. So I think we have very little faith in the ability for humans to have trust without having these huge artificial systems of justice and law and moral ambiguity that is supposed to tie us together. And I think not a lot of people trust that, because it's almost like a moral slavery that you're born into without choice. You know, and I'm not saying that there isn't other communities out there that might be a lot harsher. You know, there's places that are a lot harsher than my home country of America. I'm very, very lucky to have all the material wealth in the world at my disposal, and I've never struggled and I've never starved, and I should be grateful for all these things. But maybe there's a chance that 50, 100 years from now, there could be a different code of conduct where less people feel alienated from it and more people feel part of it and are imbued in their decision making and with a utilitarian perspective, sort of like what Mill was saying, maybe we can design and have a better system of codes and conduct. And we don't have to have a prison system that is overflowing and privatized to turn into these massive financial machines. Like, I always think that there's another way. Within complexity and overcomplicating, really, is there not a space for Occam's razor to come in and to cut off a little bit of fat, and perhaps the boat can produce and grow faster if it doesn't have a bunch of dead weight on it? know, some things to think about, I guess. I've also been reading through, I was telling you about it last week. It's called The Psychedelic Experience by Timothy Leary, Richard Alpert, and Ralph Metzger. It's a fascinating book. It's a manual for altered conscious states that can be utilized while alive, while we're awake, conscious. But it's through the lens of Tibetan Buddhism, in particular the Bardo Thordal, which is the Tibetan Book of the Dead or the Natural Book of Great Liberation through hearing. And having read through the esoteric, unrelatable Eastern traditional one first, it's fantastic being able to go through this one. And I'm going to teach it soon on here. I'm going to do a good study. I'm going to make some notes, and I'm going to try to give an outline perhaps next week or the week after that. But it's a fascinating book, and anybody who's in the world of psychedelia should at least read a little bit of it, even if it doesn't apply to all aspects of your practice. It's a wonderfully powerful book. And one of the things I gleaned from it this morning is a section from the third Bardo, which has to do with re-entry. And it's this awkwardness that comes from being in that space of other and on the way back to game states of consciousness, which these are ego games, because the temporary disillusionment and dissolving of this ego leads to this mystical experience that has transformative effects on people. So when coming back, and in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, it's re-entry into life during reincarnation. One has, if one has the presence, the awareness, and the recognition of one's state, one can choose re-entry into a particular form, which can be lower than human and an animal, bestial, or a neurotic preta, somebody who is perpetually unhappy, and like this is kind of the addict in my head, is somebody who's burning themselves, trying to make themselves happy with the thing that's making them unhappy. And below that is the hell realms of psychosis. And at the top is the devas and the godly realms of supreme pleasure, and the asuras or the titans and the heroes, and I think it's where the helping complex comes from. And there's the humans, which are perpetually in ignorance, physically and intellectually stunted and unable to see outside of that frame. But the Buddha, the enlightened, the Brahma, the Para-Atman, the essential core and spark, embodies all worlds of being, including the darkness and the good. So no matter where one is reborn, with awareness, one can see who he or she actually is, and one can be liberated at any moment. And the death process could be a metaphor for the living process. And perhaps we are all reborn many times throughout our lives as we rethink and recreate who we are. And that's immense power. So just some stuff to consider again. Thank you so much for being here. I really enjoy talking to you. I think you're a fantastic human being. I'm grateful that you woke. I hope your dreams touched you. I hope you find something intriguing and you discover something about yourself this week. If you'd ever like to discuss anything with me or just have a conversation, if you're having a hard time in life, if you just need a friend, please reach out to me at my email address, thegingerbreadmansdialogues@gmail.com. I also have a Facebook page. I'm always here for you. I want to be part of your support structure, and I want you to feel strong enough to go support others. So be love and love you. I'm going to go grab some books and we'll do a little bit of quotes before Odin sends us off into this next beautiful week. Firstly, I'm reading from the book Awakening the Buddha Within, Tibetan Wisdom for the Western World by Lama Suryadas. Now, I've heard about this guy I've heard him mentioned several times by people like Ram Dass and others, Watts. No idea he was a white guy. He is an American Lama. He left to Nepal in the early 70s after the 60s movement and found several Lamas, starting with Lama Yeshe. Kalu Rinpoche was of a lineage of Tibetan Buddhism. And so he had all these transformative, amazing, beautiful, he was very lucky, it seems like, at least how he tells the story, who knows. And then he comes back to the West to try to teach this concept of Dzogchen Tibetan Buddhism to peoples whose material minds can barely even think about some of these ideas. All right. So this is from the chapter Deconstructing the House That Ego Built. He has a way with words that I like. This is talking about the three poisons, which are kind of like afflictive states of mind that are sometimes referred to as negative or conflicting emotions, also known as klesha, unhealthy emotions. First one is ignorance. Second one is attachment. Poison three, which is where I will read now, is aversion. Aversion is another word for dislike. John's girlfriend left him for a close friend. He really dislikes them both. Dick's landlord keeps raising his rent. Dick really dislikes greedy people. Most frequently, we form aversions or dislikes in response to frustrated attachments. Meryl feels anxious and insecure when she is alone. She hates feeling that way. We don't like it when we don't get what we want. We don't like unpleasant experiences. When dislike is reinforced, it often escalates to anger, hate, and enmity. The three poisons usually work together to create pain in this fashion. Because we are ignorant of the truth, we think we can be made happy by fulfilling our attachments of a specific person, place, thing, or feeling. Inevitably, we are disappointed, and then aversion, dislike, or even hatred rears its ugly head. The tragic cycle plays itself out in a myriad ways, from the mundane to the cataclysmic. When you go to the supermarket attached to the notion that you will buy a pound of ripe peaches, and the only peaches you can find are green, and you become visibly annoyed, you are allowing the three poisons to perpetuate negative cycles in your life. Simple levels quarrels or escalated physical confrontations reflect this cycle, as do border disputes and gunfire between nations. I think it adds to help another ingredient or poison to this frustrating group of klesha: resistance to change. As every psychologist and physicist knows, we all have a tendency to resist change, particularly in those areas where we need transformation. Freud was very articulate in pointing out that a resistance to changing for the better is one of the defining characteristics of neurosis. The fact is that we all tend to hang on to our negative habits and frozen behavior patterns. We keep retracing our steps. We keep walking in the same circular patterns. We don't climb out of our ruts, our comfort zones, however dissatisfying they really feel. And lastly, I'm going to be reading from The Psychedelic Experience by Leary, Metzner, and Alpert, specifically the part that had me thinking about my little commentary earlier. This is from the third bardo, the period of reentry, also called the Sipa bardo. The types of reentry made can profoundly color the person's subsequent attitudes and feeling about himself and the world for weeks or even months afterwards. A session which has been predominantly negative and fearful can still be turned to great advantage, and much can be learned from it, provided the reentry is positive and highly conscious. Conversely, a happy and revelatory experience can be made valueless by a fearful or negative reentry. The key instructions of the third bardo are: do nothing, stay calm, passive and relaxed, no matter what happens. And two, recognize where you are. If you do not recognize, you will be driven by fear to make a premature and unfavorable re-entry, Only by recognizing can you maintain the state of calm, passive concentration necessary for a favorable reentry. That is why so many recognition points are given. If you fail on one, it is always possible up to the very end to succeed on another. Hence, these teachings should be read carefully and remembered well. Okay, I'm going to skip forward a little bit. All right. The first recognition part of the third bardo is the feeling of supernormal perception and performance. A second sign of the third bardo existence are experiences of panic, torture, and persecution. A third sign is a kind of restless, unhappy wandering, which may be purely mental or may involve actual physical movement. The person feels as if driven by winds or karma, or shunted around mechanically. There may be brief respites at certain points or scenes in the ordinary human world. Fourth, the person may feel stupid and full of incoherent thoughts, whereas everyone else seems to be perfectly knowing and wise. The fifth is a feeling of being dead, cut off from surrounding life, and full of misery. Sixth, one may have a feeling of being oppressed or crushed or squeezed into cracks and crevices amidst rocks and boulders. And a seventh is a kind of gray twilight suffusing everything, which is marked contrast to the brilliant, radiating lights and colors of the earlier stages of the voyage. So, a lot of these signs could be perspective and could change depending on who you are. But I do relate to a lot of those systems of thoughts. I've been there. This wandering aimlessly always hits me, because a lot of the times I'll find myself in this neurotic state of mind where I'm looking and seeking, especially on my way back, because I've spent the separation from my wanting and needing. And then as I feel my wanting and needings come back, I become unsteady and I start to wander. And I'm looking for something to soothe me. But because of my current state of mind, I'm not all the way back yet. I don't have the ability to play the ego games right. And I'm unable to just be the ego, really. And so this separation between the ideal and what is actually happening brings an unsteady sadness. And so I related to that one heavily. And about how a really good experience can be shunted by a negative reentry. Like, I've had a lot of really amazing times, and then just, like I exactly just explained, got neurotic on the way down, and then just had a depressed rest of the afternoon, even though it could have been amazing and beautiful. But instead of alchemizing the experience and trying to get into a holy headspace on my way down, I allowed myself to go into neurosis. And the same can be said about a horribly uncomfortable experience, like with DMT. I've had a lot of really hard trips that were physically overwhelming, but because of my headspace on the way back, I was able to transmute it, and those turned into amazing teaching moments and revelations, really. And part of that was because of my ego being able to rationalize into something very important. So, more considerations. Okay. I love my books. I'm gonna go get them.
Hello. I really want to talk today, so.
Why?
I'm in school, but don't want to talk.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you for being honest.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Bye.
Bye.